Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Michael Benson. He's a writer, artist, and filmmaker whose work explores the intersection of art and science, and we're talking about his new book, Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. Michael, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on. I appreciate it.
Now, for those of you who don't know, 2001 A Space Odyssey premiered Washington, D.C., April 2nd, 1968. I am afraid to believe that that's 50 years ago because I saw it the first year it came out.
Huh. Yeah, me too, by the way. I was 6 years old, and my mom took me to see it completely blew my mind, you know, to use a totally hackneyed phrase. And, it's kind of the rest is history for me. I was fascinated by that film for the rest of my life. So it was really a pleasure to be able to get backing from Simon & Schuster and research it, you know, and kind of look under the hood and find out how they made that thing.
Well, I want to talk to you about that because this book is so rich in detail and background information. What was it like to try to research this book? It seems like it must have been years in the making.
Well, it wasn't, actually. I mean, in some ways, it was years in the making, you know, because I saw it when I was six, and ever since then, I've been fascinated by it. And I did meet Arthur C. Clarke, got to know him in the last decade of his life, and I discussed the film with him. So I actually met him in the year 2001, fortuitously enough.
Oh, wow.
And then later, I worked with Terrence Malick on his film Tree of Life, and worked on some of the cosmological sequences there, and I got to know Doug Trumbull as part of that. Yeah. He was one of the four lead visual effects guys on 2001. This is all before the book.
Wow. Now, you start out, and I thought this was pretty brilliant, that you view 2001 as one of the iterations, one of the best 20th century iterations on Homer's Odyssey. Talk to me, and what's the other one?
Oh, the other one is James Joyce's Ulysses. And so I discussed this in the, you know, the prologue to the book. That's more of a film term. I mean, it's actually, you know, the preface. I guess the prologue is a literary term, too. Anyway, so James Joyce, you know, famously collapsed the Odysseus's years of wanderings around among the islands of the Eastern Mediterranean to one single day. And Ulysses, you know, the great Greek heroic warrior king, became a Jewish cuckold named Bloom, you know. And wandered around, you know, in the novel, Bloom wanders around Dublin, provincial Dublin, and the readers get to sort of partake of his very rich inner meditations. And so 24, you know, years of wandering became 24 hours in the life of a Jewish cuckold in Dublin for Joyce. And then with Kubrick and Clarke, they expanded the parameters of Homer's Odyssey vastly to encompass 4 million years of human evolution. And we start out with the dawn of man, you know, with these man apes in East Africa, Southwest Africa. And then the film ends with this rebirth of the human species in the year 2001. Jeez. So you have this vast expansion of the parameters of the Odyssey. So my point is that each of them, Joyce and Kubrick, or I should say Joyce and Kubrick and Clarke, because it really was a partnership with that film, they each had their different strategies on how to tackle Homer's great text.
Let's talk about this because central to this book, although there's so much information in this book, is this relationship and the working relationship between Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke. And I'm afraid a lot of people don't remember who Arthur C. Clarke was. So let's start with him. He was living in what was then called Ceylon, which is now called Sri Lanka, was a very famous science fiction writer. Talk to me about what he wrote.
Well, so Clarke wrote, he also wrote nonfiction. I'll get to that in a minute. But of his fictional output, he wrote quite a number of extremely good short stories, one of which, 2001, is sort of based on in part. And he also wrote some really, truly epic visionary novels. The most famous one is called Childhood's End.
Right.
And Childhood's End is about an alien super race arriving you know, in a flash with major, with huge starships which park themselves above each of the major cities of Earth and put all of our stupid provincial tribal, you know, quarrels and battles and wars to a stop, you know, deus ex machina fashion, and effectively then shepherd the human species to a species-wide rebirth. So you can already see the outlines of 2001 in that novel, which was written in the early 50s. The short story that 2001 is most closely aligned with is called The Sentinel, and that involves a group of lunar explorers stumbling across a crystal pyramid mounted on top of a mountaintop on the moon, and realizing that it was put there millions of years previously by an alien species that effectively wanted to kind of put a warning system, or a, you know, Clark calls it a burglar alarm, so that if the life that had been, that was visible millions of years before on Earth, on the Earth, ever succeeded in developing intelligence and the ability to bridge the gap between the Earth and the Moon and find this artifact, then the alien species that put it there would be you know, made aware of this fact. And that, of course, is the, you know, that became the monolith of 2001.
That's right. Now let's talk about Stanley Kubrick. At this point in his career, he had made several really important movies: Paths of Glory. He had made Lolita. Right. He had made Doctor Strangelove.
Yes.
But he hadn't really worked in color yet, had he?
Not Paths of Glory. Okay, I'm blanking here. Maybe we can rerun this.
That's okay.
What was his great film that he did in Hollywood? You know, the great epic with Kirk Douglas, for God's sake.
Oh, Spartacus.
Spartacus.
Spartacus. Yeah. You're right.
I always forget that
Kubrick did Spartacus. Now,
right, so let's try that again, because you're going to edit this, right?
No. That's okay. It just goes on.
All right. Whatever.
He's working on a new picture, and this is what your book answers, and I find it really fascinating. He just sort of gets this thing that he wants. He really desires to make a, quote, really good science fiction movie. Where did that come from?
Well, that came from, you know, his reading the science. You know, they used to call them the pulps because they were printed on cheap paper. You know, these monthly magazines that had science fiction stories and lots of drawings and so forth, which Clark was contributing to, and Robert Heinlein was contributing to, and Eric Asimov was contributing to. So when he was a kid, he read a lot of science fiction, and he found it really interesting. Although, you know, he said to Tony Fruin, who was his assistant during the 2001 period, you know, he mentioned to Tony Fruin that he found the characterizations of the people quite shallow in science fiction, which is kind of ironic, because people pointed out later that with 2001, you know, the people are practically robotic, and the only truly human-ish character is the supercomputer HAL. But that was, of course, very intentional.
Right. But okay, so how does he link up with Arthur C. Clarke?
Well, he wrote So I found out during the research on this book, that Kubricks were friends with Artie Shaw, the great, you know, jazz player, jazz musician. I'm aware I'm talking to a jazz musician, effectively. So Artie Shaw had stopped playing and was working on writing short stories, and also he was a film distributor in the mid-60s. And the Kubricks, I mean Stanley and Christiane, became friends with Artie and his wife, and they would hang out. And at one point it became clear to Stanley that Artie Shaw was also a science fiction fan, and he confided to him that he was interested in doing a film and that he was reading various writers. And Shaw said, well, you got to read Arthur Clarke, and it's going to start with Childhood's End. And so that was how Kubrick heard about Clarke. He may have known about him before, but he was reminded in any case. And he went off, the two of them went off, Christiane and Stanley went off and read Childhood's End, and Christiane described to me this sense of revelation on the part of Stanley as he read it. You know, and they had a cheap paperback, and so Stanley would peel off a chapter as soon as he finished it from the binding, pass it over to Christian and say, you got to read this.
Wow. So he finally makes contact with Office C. Clark, and they have their first full meeting, like person-to-person meeting. The meeting went on for 8 hours.
Yeah, the meeting went on for 8 hours, and then almost every other meeting after that went on for hours and hours and hours, because Stanley Kubrick had this ability, as Christian told me, to just kind of suck the information out of anybody who he found of interest. But as I said in my book, you know, it was really a meeting on a fairly equal level of abilities and knowledge. You know, Kubrick had the ability to make brilliant films. Clark had a body of work and ideas that he'd been working with for decades, you know, which was absolutely camera ready, you know. And so it was just the perfect kind of, you know, mid to late 60s collaboration. I've actually compared it to Lennon and McCartney.
Yeah.
The sense that one of them was a kind of cold-eyed realist a bit, and, you know, had a slightly jaundiced eye, and that would be Kubrick or John Lennon. And then Clark was a techno-utopian and very, very optimistic. That would be McCartney.
Wow.
And it was that kind of collaboration, you know.
What's amazing reading your book, and again, I cannot strongly enough recommend your book. It is absolutely fascinating. There's so much detail in it.
Thanks for saying that.
So much of the film was sort of made up as they went along. There were so many points at which they couldn't settle. It just sort of seemed like that they were creating the story as they went along. Is that safe to say?
It is very safe to say. And by the way, referring to jazz.
I can see this.
That level of improvisation, that type of improvisation would normally be a recipe for total disaster, because film is not a medium, you know, that lends itself to that kind of improvisation. But Kubrick had the type of mind, you know, that was capable of doing that, even with this mega, big budget, complex, technically complex, conceptually ambitious, you know, production. He managed to bring it off. So, you know, as I said in my book, certainly in the talks that I've been giving lately, it could have been a Heaven's Gate situation.
Oh, yeah. You said that in the book.
Right. It could have crashed the studio, but instead it was the highest grossing film of 1968, despite negative reviews and incomprehension by the older generation.
Well, skipping ahead to the reviews, that was for me, and I remember that because I was in college at the time. The critics, what was the problem? Did they just not understand that level of filmmaking? It is an abstract film.
You know what happened? Here's my analysis. When films moved from the silent period to becoming talkies, especially American films, they became very static and they became filmed plays.
Right.
Effectively.
Right.
And everything was explained for the viewer, and they were not very visually innovative. So let's set aside European avant-garde film for the moment. You know, when Kubrick got MGM's support for this ambitious space opera or space film, not opera, space film, epic narrative, they assumed that it would be a very coherent, comprehensible, sort of traditional film, how the West was won, except in the cosmos. And Kubrick had other ideas, which, you know, grew over time. And he made it, you know, willfully opaque and mysterious whenever he had a choice or the possibility to spell out for the viewer what was going on. He chose to make it ambiguous. And the interesting thing about that kind of gamble is it can easily lead to total disaster, with everybody, not just the critics, but also the audience, just going the other way. In this case, the older entitled critics who were used to kind of conventional dramas didn't get it, mostly. There were exceptions. You know? And then the younger generation flocked to it. And as I said, made it the highest grossing film of 68.
You're listening to WSN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Michael Benson, writer, artist, filmmaker, whose work explores the intersection of art and science. And we're talking about his book, I cannot recommend it enough, Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. I just want to talk about one element in the film that'll show you. We were talking about the improvisational aspect about deciding on things as they go on. Let's talk about the monolith. As you mentioned, originally it was like a pyramid in that short story. And then there's a great story that was it Stanley or who went to the Perspex convention and asked them if they can make a really big, clear pyramid. And they said, well, you know, really something the proportions of a cigarette pack are better.
Would be better. Yeah, indeed. So that was Tony Masters, the great production designer who hasn't gotten enough credit for 2001.
Oh, my God.
Doug Trumbull. Yeah. Doug Trumbull, who I mentioned earlier, pointed out to me that Tony Masters is really one of the great figures responsible for 2001 success, because he conceived of a lot of those kinetic shots, for example, with the astronauts running in circles, upside down and right way up and upside down again in the centrifuge set, this kind of hamster wheel set. Anyway, Tony Masters was effectively tasked by the director by Stanley to go off to a Perspex fair. That's how the Brits called plexiglass, probably then and still now. And off he went, you know, to find out, yes, as you just said, you know, how to make a pyramid out of clear material. And that was directly descended from the sentinel of Clark's story. And then indeed, you know, he was told it would be a lot easier to make it in the shape of a pack of smoke. And he brought that back to Stanley, and then Stanley said, okay, well, if that's true, let's do it in that shape, you know. And by the way, this kind of bargaining is common to most films. You know, you have all kinds of back and forth and collaboration and modification of vision in film, and then the director ends up getting all the credit for having conceived of everything in advance. It doesn't work that way.
This is a really great of many great stories in your book. So they make a giant Perspex monolith, and they
at great expense at the expense of a mid-sized home in central London. I mean, we're talking lots of money, and we're talking about the entire budget. We're talking the budget of a Godard film, you know, for one object, which they brought in, and Stanley was brought to see. They, you know, put it up on a soundstage, lit it carefully, polished it, and brought in Stanley Kubrick. And his reaction was, "Oh no! Oh God! It's greenish! It's greenish! You can't just see through it, you know." And Tony Masters said, "Well, yes, Stanley, it is. You know, quite a bit of perspex, Stanley. You know." And so then Kubrick said, "Well, shelve it." And Master said, "What?" You know, and then they put it away, and then it was Masters, and this is kind of the punchline of that story. So they're walking back to Stanley's office, and Tony Masters had a reputation for thinking fast and very creatively on his feet and so on. And so Kubrick was kind of ruefully meditating on the disaster that he had just brought about, which is, you know, the plexiglass monolith. And then Master said, "I'll tell you what, Stanley, why don't we just make a black monolith, and then nobody will know what it is." And Kubrick thought about it and said, "Okay, do that."
Now, how did they get that real good black? It's an amazing black.
No, that was mixing graphite into black paint. So you have this metallic sheen. And then they also went through dozens of monoliths before they got one that looked as perfect as the one in the film does.
Now, we had mentioned Douglas Trumbull, and this book is just rife with important people and what they did on the film. And I want to talk about Douglas Trumbull, because later he became one of the most important special effects people. But he was a kid during the filming of 2001. What was he originally hired to do?
So he was originally hired. He cold called Stanley Kubrick from L.A., and he had been working with a company called Graphic Films, which had done some preliminary work for Stanley Kubrick on 2001. And then he basically got fired because he was a part-time employee anyway. And then they got fired by Kubrick because they were in L.A. and Kubrick was going to London, and it was just, they were too far away. So they got fired. So then Trumbull realized that he really wanted to continue working on that film. And he called Kubrick. He got the number, called Kubrick, and explained who he was. And yeah, you're right. He was like 20.
Oh, my God.
You know, 20 years old. He said, I've been doing drawings for you of moon bases, and I want to continue working on this project. And Kubrick said, fantastic. You know, we'll send you a plane ticket and pay you this much per week and, you know, come on over. So, yeah, he did come over. And then he was originally hired as an animator, really. He'd only done animation. You know, he started out as an animator who was learning photography, and he emerged from that production 2.5 years later as one of the absolute top practitioners of optically based visual effects in the world.
It's amazing because he was doing like really sort of the little stuff that you see in the background of the movie that really lends it realism, like stuff that would be on the computer screen, I think, wasn't it? He was like doing that kind of stuff. And then he just seemed to be really good at problem solving. And that
And then he ended up doing a significant and probably the most spectacular part of that, you know, the so-called Stargate sequence, which is when Dave Bowman, the astronaut, the surviving astronaut from the Discovery mission to Jupiter, ends up vaulting through space and time in this kind of cosmic joyride, under the supervision, presumably, of these invisible aliens. And sees this kind of light show, this cosmic light show shooting at him. And that was Doug Trumbull's innovation with a technique called slit scan.
Now, again, there is so much we could talk about in this book. The question of the aliens was one that had to be sort of wrestled out throughout the beginning parts initially, didn't Arthur C. Clarke want to show aliens, like actually show an alien?
Well, both of them did. And in fact, if anything, it was more Stanley who felt like they needed to show it would, you know, the audience might feel cheated if after all of, you know, the whole plot unfolds, you don't see aliens at the end in some way. And in an initial draft of the script, you have this skinny, tall, kind of Giacometti sculpture-ish alien taking the surviving astronaut by the hand and walking off into the sunset, effectively, which is something you might expect to see in a Spielberg film, but not a Kubrick film. And indeed, it was cut. But they did try throughout the film, particularly at the end, they were trying and trying and trying to come up with an alien that would work, and they failed.
And that was
I think it helped the movie in the end.
Because, no kidding. I think it really was one of the more important decisions. And we're going to run out of time here. I want to talk about Hal, because initially that computer didn't have such a huge role in the movie at all, but it ended up being a critical sort of pivot to what was going to happen later, that they could sort of focus in on that and have the lobotomy scene, which was amazing. That really, I mean, Hal's role really developed throughout them creating this film.
Yeah, now Hal's role developed because Kubrick and Clarke were consulting the best minds in the business, and I'm talking about Marvin Minsky, co-founder of the MIT Artificial Intelligence Lab, IBM, Bell Labs, et cetera. We're talking about the top people in the country in the 60s. You know, they were consulting with them, and as they consulted, Hal's IQ grew, effectively. And I have this kind of priceless letter from Roger Karras, who was Kubrick's vice president and close associate, and who had been interfacing with various companies. And he had been consulting with IBM, and IBM sent him, the Elliott Noyes Design Bureau, which I've compared to the Apple Design Bureau, except of the 60s. A real think tank, technology think tank, design think tank. They sent a suggestion that in the early 21st century, supercomputers might have a kind of a brain room that you could go inside of. And Kubrick was clearly in a kind of uncharacteristically defeatist frame of mind when he received that letter, and he wrote back and said, this is complete, hogwash. I mean, he didn't use those terms. He said, this is a complete waste of time. Unfortunately, they're not giving us what we need. We're wasting time. And he completely dismissed this idea. And then clearly he thought about it over the weekend or what have you. And the end result was that fantastic scene that you mentioned.
I know.
You know, where Dave Bowman is floating within the mind, within the brain room of Hal, and deprogramming him as the computer pleads for its life.
One of the things you say in the book is, and this was one of the rumors that was from day one in this film, is that the name Hal was just one letter up from IBM, but you said that they would not own up to that.
Well, I don't think it was conscious. I really,
I find that that's like Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds is not about LSD.
Okay, we're back at Lennon and McCartney, aren't we?
But that's like, I find that hard to believe that it's so perfect. But you're saying no.
Well, let me tell you one reason why I think I believe that. I stumbled on a videotape interview with Clark done in '68, and he said that they came up with the name Dave Bowman, and it took them months to realize that last name referred to Odysseus. They didn't
consciously know.
Right. Yeah. You know, and of course Odysseus shot an arrow through the axe handles, you know, very famously at the end of the Odyssey and achieved his kingdom back. He was the bowman. But they did it unconsciously. And so I do believe that they did that unconsciously. And by the way, it was Marvin Minsky of MIT who suggested the terms behind Hal, which are heuristic algorithmic, you know.
Yeah.
And I doubt he had IBM in mind when he did so.
We've got just minutes to, and again, we could be talking about this book for years.
Right.
How did Arthur C. Clarke like the finished film?
Arthur Clarke tried to disguise it and succeeded quite well in disguising it, but his initial screenings of the film were a big shock to him. He felt like it was too opaque. It was not understandable. And, you know, after the first screening in D.C., he was quoted by British journalists as saying, you have to watch it 5 or 6 times before you understand it.
Right.
So he was clearly upset. And I also have a scene in my book where he left the New York premiere in tears, effectively.
Right.
Because the audience was so restless and people were leaving and he felt like it was a flop. So, but then he came around and then, you know, fairly soon, we're talking May, June of '68, within a couple of months, month or so of it coming out, he was already saying to journalists that Stanley's decision to keep things opaque was the right decision and preserved the mystery.
Again, like I mentioned, we could be talking about this great book for a while. My guest tonight has been Michael Bentzen, writer, artist, and filmmaker whose work explores the intersection of art and science. And a great example of that is this book, Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. It's a great read. This is one of the great summer books to read. Michael, it's been a pleasure.
Hey, thank you, Mark. I really appreciate those kind words. Thanks a lot. It's been fun to talk to you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.